Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And before we get going, if things sound a little bit different this week, it's because I bought a new microphone for the first time in about 7 years. It's a lovely new dynamic microphone from Rode. If things sound a little bit different, it is me. It is not you. On this week's show, we are taking a look at a mediocre response from Microsoft's Security Response Center in the face of a fairly run-of-the-mill bug report. Our guest today found some Microsoft software was failing to validate SSL certificates. The software in question is a PowerShell utility used with Office 365. But yeah, he reported it and then was told it wasn't an issue because, drumroll please, the attacker would require man in the middle. What? It all got sorted out eventually, and by sorted out, I mean silently patched with no note to customers. So if you have a script running somewhere that's invoking this tool, it's probably not checking for valid certificates, so that's fun. But we're going to have a chat about all of that a little bit later on. But yeah, safe to say, Microsoft kind of dropped the ball on that one. In this week's show notes, we'll be talking with industry legend John Oberhide, the co-founder of Duo Security, about a couple of things, actually. We'll be looking at the features platform vendors like Microsoft and Google are now baking into their operating systems, features that allow companies like Duo to be able to query the health of endpoints. And we also have a general conversation about how it is actually the platform vendors themselves who solve the biggest problems, not so much the security industry and makers of third-party tools. That is this week's sponsor interview, with big thanks to Duo Security, and it is coming up a little bit later on. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news. And this week we are joined by the Gruck, who is filling in for Adam Boileau. And Gruck, we've got some more detail on the CC cleaner, or however you want to say it, that malware outbreak involving some supply chain shenanigans over at Avast. And it looks like this may have been a pretty organized attack against some pretty specific targets using supply chain infiltration.
This is amazingly cool stuff. So they get into Avast. They hit at least 700,000 machines, right, with this stage one gatherer, but they only infect 20, right? These aren't your average, you know, like ransomware or mass hack guys. This is very, very targeted stuff.
Yeah, they weren't dropping Lockheed. I mean, we're looking at Singtel, HTC, Samsung, Sony, Cisco, you know, like Linksys, all technology companies for the most part, at least.
Right, and it's in interesting list, because it even includes a dynamic DNS target, right? Like that's some pretty specific research that they did before they got there. Like they're not just looking for generic Linksys, right? Like this is a dynamic DNS thing. So this is like they're going after people or groups that they specifically want. That's quite involved. Like this is a hardcore crew.
Yeah, no, right. It really is. And one thing that I find interesting about this is Cisco Talos, who've been doing the work on this one, they published some analysis saying that they were provided with a copy of the CNC box, which is kind of interesting. So either they owned it themselves and were, you know, that's how they were provided it, is in they provided it to themselves. But I think I read somewhere else that they were provided with this information from a so-called intelligence partner. But either way, they actually got this info by dumping the C2.
I'm skeptical of the intelligence partners. Like intelligence agencies are sort of information black holes. A lot of things go in, not much comes out. If they had said like a national cert gave it to them, yeah, sure.
Yeah, but still, marketing department might have insisted on that being called an intelligence partner because it does sound cool.
right. That sounds a lot better. Sounds a lot better than, you know, France cert happened to have, you know, an OVH box that they gave us. But the specificity and the fact that these guys had the discipline to ignore they had 700K infections that they ignored. That they were like, we're not going to monetize this. These don't provide any value to us. These don't interest us. Let's hit these 20 guys.
Well, what's interesting too about this one is we don't really know, you know, there's no clear indicator as to who's behind it. It's a bit of a mystery campaign at the moment.
Right. You know, looking at what Cisco's put out, literally the only link, at least publicly, the only link that they have is this thing where it says set time zone, to PRC, which just, like, that's so, you know, for people to be so good at everything else, they've got this multi-stage gathering, then a second stage loader, which brings in a third stage completely in-memory malware, which doesn't leave any traces to do its stuff, that they would accidentally set the time zone to their own local one.
Yeah, but screw-ups happen. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, that is the only hint in the Telos analysis, but it is, I guess what I'm saying is that we just don't know yet with this one.
Right,
and we don't really
right.
know what the objective is. I mean, this could have been an attempt to further propagate supply chain infiltration for, you know, working towards some larger goal, or it might have been about obtaining information directly from those handful of companies that were targeted in this. We just don't know.
Right. And in terms of the further supply chain stuff, the amount of investment that went into developing the attack framework and the multi-stage loader, that would indicate that they're expecting future attacks.
Mm. And I think we can safely say it was a state-backed campaign.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks it has that smell about it, but as for what state, which state, no idea. Then again, it could have been a criminal thing, right. But yeah, I doubt it. 700,000 boxes is just too many to waste. But we should move on to some other stories now. And the SEC has revealed that it got owned and quite a while ago as well. And it looks like whoever did this job was actually trading on the information that they obtained from the SEC. So this was definitely a financially motivated crime.
Yeah, well, it's nice to see some good old-fashioned, you know, not a ransomware, not a, you know, trying to get money out of grandma's. These guys are taking advantage of the market through good old-fashioned financial hacking.
Yeah, it's good to see some bread and butter, like financial, yeah. You know, like Hollywood movie hacking, right?
Exactly.
You know, this is real swordfish-style stuff.
Yes. Like, this is what Hollywood taught us to expect. This is not the day-to-day reality of malware and ransomware and that boring stuff. This is cool. They hit the SEC. They got insider information that might have given them a 30-second advantage that they were able to exploit. That, you know, well, like, that's some pretty cool stuff. SEC seems to have done a little bit of an epic fail on not bothering to mention it for a year.
Yeah, that's not exactly confidence-inspiring, is it, right?
Particularly since they wanted to build more databases with more information. The fact that they screwed up this first one so badly, and it's not even their first time, right? Like, they've been hit on this exact same spot a few times over the years.
Yeah, it's this EDGAR system, which is for, Electronic Data Gathering Analysis and Retrieval System, which seems to be like some sort of document management system involving detailed company reports. So whoever owns that gets a little bit of a window before everyone else gets it.
Yeah, so this isn't their first rodeo. You know, they've had opportunities in the past to get their stuff together, to get their act together. They have failed, quite obviously.
Look, it's not just the SEC having a bad time. Deloitte as well. This has been a big story breaking over the last few days. They had their email systems owned, apparently. And what's interesting, too, is that whoever got these creds like had access to an awful lot. And there was no 2FA on these admin accounts, which, considering Deloitte is a company that sells, you know, high-level security consulting services, you just think, what are you doing?
Right. So this is a little bit embarrassing that they would have an administrator account without 2FA, but I don't think the story is done, because I'm pretty certain that whoever was on this email system and was searching through these emails, you know, Deloitte is claiming only a very, very small number of emails were accessed. I find that a bit hard to believe.
Well, I mean, they had access to pretty much all of their email, but I think they only searched for certain terms through some of the email, right? So that's the thing. They had a lot of access. They just didn't use it.
I think more stuff will come out. Like, I've heard from other channels that people were affected.
Yeah.
So I suspect that there's a bit more than, they're downplaying this a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, the PR response from Deloitte is very funny, because they're going, very few clients have been impacted by this breach. And it's like, yeah, okay, you don't know that yet, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, we got some more news on Equifax as well. It turns out they got owned like just a few days after that Struts bug proof of concept got released back in March. So, yeah, it happened pretty quick.
So the story has shifted a bit, and I think it puts Equifax on the one hand in a bit of a better light, right? So the original thing is they only applied this patch for Struts in June, whereas now we found out that they were hacked March 10th, 4 days after the bug was put out, right? So the fact that they missed that patch window is actually like they were owned basically immediately.
Patching struts is not straightforward, right? So I mean, it's like it's a framework. You got to recompile your apps, and like that's a tough thing to do for most organizations within a few days.
Right. So that lets them off the hook on the patching side. Where they're now on the hook massively is the fact that these guys had access using web shells.
Yeah, like 30 of them, right? Is that the number that I saw? But this is the thing, right? I mean, this is the theme that we've been reporting like consistently since news of this broke is like, it's not really about the struts bug, right? I mean, you've got to assume at some point that 0 day can happen, right? Regardless of whether it's an end day bug, what's happened in this case is it was an end day bug, but they were hit a few days after notification, right? So you're not always going to be able to get, you know, your stuff patched before an attacker can take a proof of concept and own you with it. So, you know, you've got to design around that, right? Like you can't just say, oh, well, you know, if we had a patched earlier, we would have been fine. You're just never going to win that race.
Right. I mean, you have to assume you will get compromised. That's an assumption that you have to operate under. The fact that these guys got compromised, fair enough. But the fact that their architecture was so badly put together that after that compromise, someone could install 30 web shells and use that to access all of their data, including these legacy databases, which one assumes were sort of protected in that they were no longer directly accessible. They would have been sort of decommissioned in some way.
Yeah, just floating around in the DMZ somewhere, right?
Right. So, their architecture must have been awful. I think that the condemnation that we see here is not that they screwed up on struts, but that their architecture was terrible and all it took was web shells.
In other news, Facebook has revamped its political ad rules. I mean, no surprises there. They've been getting a lot of negative press over this. Now, I didn't know this, but after we spoke about this on the show last week or the week before, I actually got an email from a listener who pointed out that there isn't as much regulation for online political ads in the United States. So for things like, you know, authorizations and stuff, which I found very interesting because I just, you know, went ahead with that show assuming that they would need to carry authorizations. But now Facebook trying to tackle this problem. And, you know, we've seen some other really interesting news here about all of this because it turns out Obama had reached out to Mark Zuckerberg just before Trump's inauguration to encourage him to take this really seriously. This is, you know, you got to think this has got to be one of the top problems at Facebook right now, which considering the size and the scope of the company, I mean, that's a pretty hairy problem.
To me, what's interesting is actually Zynep pointed out that this lack of transparency on online ads is a huge issue. And she did this back in 2012. She went to the Democrats and she was like, you guys have got to, you know, put some rules in place. You can't allow this opaque world of advertising online to keep operating as it has. And the Dems didn't want to follow through with it because they thought that this was a tactical advantage for them. They didn't think that the Republicans would be able to leverage it. And what we see here is that the Republicans and the Russians and so on have been able to take advantage of online advertising and that opacity to do who knows what, because we have no transparency. We don't know what happened. So Facebook is finally doing something that they should have done at least 5 years ago. You know, people should be able to say, all right, our competitor is purchasing this ad with this demographic. Let's see what it is. And we should have an opportunity to counter that. The cynic in me says this is actually Facebook trying to sell more ads.
Yeah. Twitter, meanwhile, is about to meet with the Senate Intelligence Committee to talk about all things Russia. This is interesting.
Yes. So Twitter is facing a slightly different problem than Facebook. So Facebook has the problem that people are giving them too much money to do ads, right? Twitter has the problem that people are using their platform for free to manipulate what people are seeing. Twitter actually faces a unique problem from the Twitter bot perspective because they have that API, which makes building automated bot armies a lot easier on the Twitter platform simply by nature of having that API, which reduces the visibility that Twitter as a company has into what people are doing. So Twitter is a little bit screwed on this one. They don't have the same capability that Facebook does to clamp down on abuse in this way.
Any idea what this meeting at the Senate Intelligence Committee is going to be about?
I suspect what they're going to look at is the amount of bots, what Twitter is doing to try and reduce bot armies, and whether Twitter is sort of being proactive or not doing anything. And the problem for Twitter, of course, is that they're not doing anything because any bot account is a user account, and they are desperate for user numbers. So Twitter's going to look pretty bad on that one, I think.
Turning our attention to China, and after some experimentation, you could say, China has now fully blocked WhatsApp in the lead-up to a major Communist Party meeting. It's been up and down in recent days, and the consensus seems to be bye-bye WhatsApp in China.
The story mentions how you know, initially they were blocking video and calls. Then they moved to block file sharing, and now they've blocked text. So people might be getting scared. You know, does this mean that the signal protocol has been cracked by China and they're able to, target these subsections?
Well, no, because right. They're blocking it so that people will have to use WeChat so that the government can read their messages, right? Yeah. And that's always been China's strategy, is when a secure service pops up, they block it and funnel people towards services that are domestic and cooperate with law enforcement. Law enforcement in air quotes, intelligence services more like it. State security services would probably be the correct nomenclature there. So there you go. If you're going to China, you will not be able to stay in touch with people via WhatsApp. Seems like there's an Iranian campaign targeting the aerospace sector. And in typical Iranian campaign style, it's loaded up with wiper malware because that's how they roll.
I mean, they took Stuxnet to heart.
Yeah, they sure did.
They're trying to play catch up. Right? They realize that this is an area that they need to be in. And a lot of what they're doing is they're going into universities and being like, hey, you look promising. Here's some money. Do a thing. And then, you know, they'll go somewhere else and be like, hey, you guys look promising. Here's some money. Do a thing. Like, it doesn't seem to have a coordinated, for example, a Five Eyes hierarchical, you know, here's our 15-year plan. Here's how we're going to get from A to B. Here's how we're going to structure it. Here's how we're going to train. These are the tools that we need. It's a lot more sort of like just throwing money at different people and doing different stuff.
That's how a lot of these governments stand stuff up, though. I mean, that's not new. But we should point out, too, that this analysis comes from FireEye, the so-called APT-33 crew has broken into a U.S. aerospace organization. They were actually collecting, but then moved on to the wiper stuff. So, yes, very typical of the style. Cloudflare, meanwhile, is now going to provide unmetered DDoS mitigation without extra costs to its entire client base, which is, that's a bit of a killer selling point. I'd imagine they're going to do well out of that until someone stands up Mirai 2 and costs them a lot of money.
Good on them. DDoS these days is a serious problem for smaller groups, given how cheap it is to throw huge amounts of traffic at someone. They've gone to 11. You know, they've said, we're going to do all of your DDoS, not just the first however many gigabytes. So good for them in bringing the service up to a really good standard of protection. They will pay for it.
We'll see, right? Because it's all about protection in aggregate. And, you know, they've got 15 terabits apparently of capacity. They can absorb that much. So, you know, whether or not, once you've got that capacity, whether or not you're using it to defend Brian Krebs's website or you're using it to defend against, an attack against Facebook or whatever, like, it doesn't really change the equation for you. So we'll just see. We'll just see if that works for them from a business sense. This next piece is interesting. I don't like using bug names, but I'm going to use one. Dirty Cow, which was a Linux privask, mostly patched. It's a kernel bug in Linux, but apparently because it's a reliable exploit, there's like 1,200 apps now available for Android that are using it to root devices, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and of course, this is based on the fundamental problem with Android, that once you get an Android, it doesn't get patched, and that's it. You know, most of your Android devices are these very, very old Linux kernels, which, you know, are going to have a lot of vulnerabilities because they're not being constantly updated and patched all the time. And obviously, patching the kernel is the hardest thing to do for a phone.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's a great bug if you're looking at compromising handsets, because that's the way Android works. They use different user accounts for different apps, right? So if you've got a Privesk via the kernel, hooray. And this particular bug, it's, you know, you can, pretty much anything can touch it. So, you know, that's, it's just an interesting story about how these bugs actually wind up being used in the wild. It's taken a year, but now it's everywhere.
Right. And I mean, Dirty Cow is so good, it can actually bypass GRSec, right? Like this is a golden bug. This is awesome. The only way to do anything about it is to patch. And the only thing you can't do on Android is patch.
Depending on your model, we should point that out. But yeah, you're right. They lag behind big time. It's only a year old bug. There's a lot of vulnerable devices out there. Let's see. Bleeping Computer has reported that Project Zero has released a proof of concept exploit for a remote iPhone 7 Wi-Fi bug. That one looks kind of interesting. It's patched now with iOS 11. So, but I mean, bug hunters, I'm sure, will be interested in that one. There's another bug too, affecting all macOS versions up to the current version, which allows any app, basically signed or unsigned, to walk your keychain content in plain text out the front door. That's, you know, that's less than ideal. speaking of leaks, Adobe. Now, this is, look, people have made a little bit too much out of it, but it's still a funny story. Adobe's PCert, like product security team, actually accidentally published a private key for a newly generated PGP key, which was, you know, and put it on their blog, which is just, you know, it's funny. It's a bit of an oops. It was only a three-day-old key. Even if it was an older key, what are you going to be able to decrypt if you've captured PGP mail? Like, it's going to be information on bugs that are no doubt patched. So look, the real world impact of this is, you know, pretty negligible, but it's still just pretty funny, and goes to show too that PGP is, you know, pretty easy thing to screw up.
So it just goes to show that using PGP is a bit of a UI horror show. You know, the user experience is terrible. Even security teams struggle to get this right. As you said, it's not a huge deal. You know, it's not like you're getting all of their backlog is suddenly exposed. You know, it's embarrassing.
And it means that we can laugh about them on Twitter. Now, look, we've got a pretty troubling story out of the United Kingdom. This guy, Mohammed Rabbani, who works for an advocacy organization called CAGE, he's been found guilty of a terrorism offense for failing to decrypt information at the border when he flew into Heathrow. He had apparently taken some statements from someone who was alleging mistreatment at the hands of, you know, American authorities. And, you know, this guy is an advocate for people who've wound up on the wrong side of terror laws. And here he is being told that he needs to decrypt information. He refused. And now guilty. I mean, look, they're not sending him to prison, but that's not the point. This guy shouldn't have a terrorism law conviction on his record for this. This is just nuts.
Yeah, no, like they're just trying to abuse the information that he would have collected against his client, or, you know, potential other things. They're trying to use him to gain access, and it should be protected. The abuse is absolutely crazy. Like, CAGE does very, very good work, particularly, like, these guys are not focused on, you know, like getting terrorists out of jail. These guys are focused on getting redress for people who have been physically abused, you know, like people who've been tortured, people who've been, you know, treated quite badly by the system. Like this is a group that is out there protecting human rights at a human level.
Yeah, I mean, this guy is essentially a walking check and balance, right? And he's, you know, got the authorities trying to have a free look at his data. He just refused to hand over his password. And I think, you know, I'd look, if I were him, I would do exactly the same thing. So this is just another example. I mean, look, the British did the same thing to Glenn Greenwald's partner during the the Snowden mm-hmm. stuff. They pulled aside his partner when he was traveling with hard drives and tried to throw terrorism legislation at him. And it's just, look, come on. That's not what these laws are for. Let's not do this. But Gruck, that is actually all we have time for this week, mate. Thank you very much for filling in for Adam and talking to us, sharing your wisdom with us about the week's news.
Yep, always a pleasure, mate. Talk to you later.
That was the Gruck there with a check of the week's security news headlines. Okay, so on to this week's feature interview now. And a couple of months back, I was contacted by a listener who was having a bit of trouble reporting a bug to Microsoft. He'd written up a nice, very clearly worded report about a Microsoft PowerShell utility used with Office 365 failing to validate SSL certificates. It was about as straight up as it gets, but the thing is, they actually bounced his report with the hilarious reasoning that in order to exploit this failure, the attacker would need to have man-in-the-middle access. What? So yeah, this listener reached out to me just to ask if I knew anyone at Microsoft who could help. The thing is, this guy who you're about to hear from, he doesn't actually work in security, so it's not like he had a deep Rolodex where he could just ask around. But anyway, I fired off a couple of tweets, wound up connecting him with someone who could help, and they actually did manage to sort it out pretty quickly after that and pay him a humble bug bounty of about $1,500. But this anecdote, this story, I mean, it feeds into rumors I've been hearing most of this year about Microsoft's response to bugs just slipping. There are rumors that Redmond lost a bunch of staff and they're just under-resourced at the moment. Now, I ran these rumors past Microsoft's PR, but they flatly refused to comment. The really funny part is they came back to me to offer some background information. And when I agreed to hear this super secret background information, they basically just told me the disclosure date of the bug, the patch date, and the bounty amount. Now, this is the information they gave me in response to my questions about staffing shortfalls and process deficiencies, and they asked me not to attribute that information to them, which I'm obviously doing right now. But I mean, come on, this is a, you know, this is a like super lame PR response. But anyway, back to the issue at hand. Microsoft did fix the bug, and once our next guest was connected with someone a little higher up the food chain, everything did go okay. But what if he couldn't be bothered asking someone outside the company to help escalate this? What would have happened then? Would that bug still be there? And the biggest question is, how often is this happening? You know, how often are they actually turning away legitimate reports? I saw a tweet a little while back where someone said they'd reported a one-click RCE in Edge to Microsoft and were told to post about it in a public forum. That was the response. Now, I'm not sure if that story was real or a joke, but the point is the chatter at the moment is, unless you're high profile, you can't really rely on the first responders at Microsoft to be able to identify what's serious and what's not. And that's a problem. So even if that was a joke, the joke is sort of reinforcing the rumors, the general scuttlebutt at the moment. Now, our PowerShell bug hunter, who you're about to hear from, he didn't want to use his name, but he did join me via Skype for this conversation about his experience. Here he is.
So I was working on seeing if I could get the PowerShell tools for Exchange Online to be able to handle multiple tenants, i.e. we're a managed service provider, so we handle other people's Office 365, and there's a way to get PowerShell to, you know, work on basically other email domains and stuff. That's not something that's directly exposed in the tools. It's a matter of how you connect. I also have two-factor authentication set up on my account. That means that I need to use Microsoft's specific tools that allow authentication, two-factor authentication to happen in connection with connecting. And I was trying to see, is there any way I can trick this tool to make it so I can make it connect to a different tenant? Now, by trick, I don't mean I'm trying to like hack into it or something. It's more like I'm trying to get it to do something that it's not explicitly designed to do. So I grab a copy of the DLLs and I throw it into .NET like disassembler called ILSpy, and I'm just reading through this code and I'm just seeing this block of code where they're disabling certificate, disabling any checks of the SSL certificate presented by the remote PowerShell server. They're disabling like revocation checks. They're disabling like, they're basically disabling all the certificate checks, like explicitly. It just says that in the code. Yeah, we're just going ahead and doing that.
But at this point, you're thinking, okay, no big deal. There's a PowerShell tool. They're not doing certificate validation. That's probably a bug, right? Like, that's probably something that they didn't intend to do. I'm guessing this was your thinking. So what did you do next?
I poked around a little bit because, you know, just reading the code, it might be I'm not reading it correctly. So I set up a tool to just man in the middle SSL connections, and I discovered that even though they are properly doing SSL validation on the actual authentication part, once you're actually doing commands, it's actually not running. So I just made it's actually not, you know, checking that you have a secure session.
And that's bad, right? Because if you could actually man in the middle these, I mean, there was actual auth info being passed around, right? So you could actually man in the middle and grab cookies and shit.
It was exactly that. I could steal some kind of an authentication token off the actual session, and then you know, clone the session, so to speak. You know, it only worked for like 10 minutes, but that's enough time to get in. So.
Yeah, that's a legitimate security issue, right? It might not be, hey, oh my God, everyone erase, you know, raise their threat alert level to, you know, hyper red, but that's a legit issue. So, I
Yeah.
mean, you know,
So if someone's using this exact tool to do management of their exchange online, and you can get a man in the middle on that, and you can pull out the man in the middle on that in such a way that is stealthy, which is actually not super easy in this particular case, then you can grab some grab a cookie out of there, and basically have full admin privileges to that particular tenant on Microsoft's.
Now, so far, we're talking about a pretty run-of-the-mill oversight from a large software manufacturer. It happens all the time. So you think, okay, I'm going to report this to Microsoft. Tell us what happened next.
So I get a response back from Microsoft. So basically, at that point, they're telling me, upon investigation, we've determined this does not meet the bar for security servicing. In this case, a man in the middle session already needs to be enacted on the target successfully.
So they're
So
saying,
basically,
YOLO, you don't need to worry about checking, doing SSL certificate validation because, hey, man in the
because
middle means
you need to be in the middle.
I know, but it does.
Yeah.
It just does not
That's what
make
certs are
sense,
for.
right? Okay,
Yeah,
so
that's
at
what
this,
certs are for. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, at this point, right? Like, I should point out, you know, sort of hit this brick wall, and then you sent me your initial report to Microsoft and their response. I looked at it and I'm like, okay, it looks like some Microsoft tool thingy isn't doing cert validation. They should probably fix that. But just to be doubly sure, I actually, with your permission, showed the bug report to Adam Boileau as well. And I'm like, look, am I crazy or is this just straight up failure to validate certs? And his response was great actually, which was, you know, not only is that what he's saying and what he's showing there, but it's also extremely well communicated. So I don't know what the hell they're thinking. So this was a weird situation, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just a single email exchange. It was a few emails back and forth where they were just basically repeating the same thing, and I'm just explaining to them, you know, they wanted specific examples. Well, how can you do man in the middle? Well, I'm like, well, you can hijack DNS, you can do BTP hijacking, you can
This
I don't
is
know,
not a
join a safe network.
conversation you should be having with Microsoft Security Response, right? Like, what is explaining to them what a man in the middle is? Like, I can't even.
Yeah, and like, how would you actually man in the middle on the internet? That's not something I need to explain to Microsoft. That's just a given, right?
From that point, I think, I mean, I didn't, you know, I didn't really do much in this situation beyond firing off a couple of tweets saying, hey, is there anyone in Microsoft Security Response? And look, I mean, someone eventually the tweet sort of bounced around and I managed to connect you with someone. And from there, things did improve a little bit, right?
Just let me point out that the fact that I reached out to you was that there was no clear, like, you know, way for me to move forward. I mean, Microsoft is a big company. They're impenetrable. I mean, if they don't respond to you on the Secura alias, you're basically just going to email them somewhere else. And you're going to be stuck with either some outsourced help desk guy who doesn't know what he's talking about, or you're going to be stuck with some receptionist somewhere who has no idea. So, I mean, for me, as someone who's not like an established like bug hunter, just, you know, or anything, I don't hunt bugs. I just found this
Yeah, I
by
mean, we
accident.
should actually point out that you don't actually work in InfoSec.
No, I work in IT.
Yeah. So you've hit the brick wall with a legitimate issue that's been well communicated. Finally, you've been connected to someone else. Now, look, to their credit, they did eventually go, oh, okay, geez, we may have screwed up here, but that took some time, didn't it? Like more time than
Yeah.
is reasonable.
At the point where you actually, you know, got their attention, which was about a week after the initial response. They did eventually get back to me and said they're going to take another look at it. At that point, I mean, there were two separate issues here. One was, you know, is the problem that I described actually there? I can respect the fact that they need to check, you know, that they don't take my word for it. That I'm telling them there is a problem, and I'm even telling them specifically, you know, what function, in what method, in what, you know, assembly the problem is in, because I did it through code disassembly. So I'm literally pointing a finger, telling them, yeah, the problem is right exactly there. Still, they need to check. I can respect that. The other thing is, this whole thing, is this type of problem even a problem, right? Is checking SSL certificates considered, is not checking SSL certificates considered to be a vuln or not? That's a conversation we were having initially, and that's one that they just, you know, didn't continue. I mean, I was left saying, yeah, we're going to take another look at it, but they didn't, you know, tell me that not checking SSL certs is definitely bad, which they should have at that point. Because it's one thing to say, yeah, we were wrong about classifying the bug. The other thing is they need time to check and fix for the actual bug. Okay, so that was like the next step in this whole story.
But I mean, that's the typical run-of-the-mill thing, right? Like, eventually they have to escalate it, they have to test it, they have to make sure it's a thing. Now, I know already from chats we've had previously that they didn't let you know when they fixed it. I mean, obviously they didn't assign it a CVE because it's, you know, it's not the sort of thing you typically assign a CVE for. So they've silently patched it. They didn't tell you, which, you know, I kind of understand, because often people will say, hey, can you let me know when this podcast is up? And I don't, right? Because I'm, you know, just a horrible person. The thing is, right, like, any company the size of Microsoft has to deal with an awful lot of crazy inbound crap, which isn't security issues, right, coming to secure at Microsoft. So, you know, I've got a little bit of sympathy there for them. But what I'm blown away by is that they just missed this one. Do you know what I mean? And it's stuff that we've heard. They've missed a few things lately, and it's, I mean, they need to do better. You would agree, I'm sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to run the security at Microsoft.com alias, because I'm sure you get all kinds of crazy people discovering crazy stuff that's not even an issue. It's like Chinese hackers are hacking my toaster, can you please help me?
Yeah. MI6 is reading my mind through my Windows computer. You know, I mean, I'm sure they get a lot of that, right? But look, really, you've just told us your story. Your story is just a tale of woe. But I guess, look, the question is, are you now discouraged from reporting issues to them in the future? Or will you just grin and bear it and do it again?
That's a big one. I think I'd do it again, but I'd probably do it again. But that's mostly because I'm that kind of a person. I just kind of want to go through the process and do things the way they're supposed to be done. But my main issue isn't, you know, did it discourage me? I can definitely see it discouraging someone else. Maybe someone who's a lot busier at work than I am.
Or someone who's reporting something, you know, more serious, but might not be in a good position to communicate that effectively because of language barriers, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I was even able to make progress was the fact that I happened to follow your podcast. It's not typical for someone in IT to follow your podcast. I mean, someone else would probably be like, well, we reported it to Microsoft and they told us it's not a problem, so I guess I'm wrong.
Well, look, thanks a lot for coming onto the show to tell us your tale of woe. You know, and thank you for reporting that bug so that it could be fixed for everyone who uses Microsoft's, you know, PowerShell tools.
It has been silently patched by Microsoft, but which would make sense if it was like JavaScript on the website. You don't, as you said, you don't issue like a CVE for like, oh, there was like some cross-siting script vuln on like our website and someone got a bounty and we fixed it. This case, this is actually code that's running locally on the user's machine. Sure, you can argue JavaScript is also code running on the local user's machine. But in this case, there's actually, you know, an installer that you bring down from the internet. You click it and it executes. Now, granted, every time you, like, from the start menu, start the application in question, start this tool, then it's going to, like, go out to Microsoft and check for updates, and basically it'll tell you, is there an update available? Yes, no. And you just press OK. There's no details about the vuln, there's just, you've got a new version, you should update. And a lot of people who use this kind of stuff don't necessarily start the actual tool from the start menu. They'll have like a script that is, you know, set to, they've Googled around and basically found someone who found out, so how can I load this thing in the script? It's not necessarily going to do the update check. So by the fact that Microsoft has not provided any information about this being a problem, people who are using this kind of stuff, they're kind of left, you know, to best practices as to keep your stuff up to date. And a module like this might not be considered, like, is this actual problem? I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, if there's code and big companies using a module like this sitting around like for years and just, you know, not being updated, because it doesn't turn up in Microsoft updates. It just turns up in this tool's built-in thing.
That was a friend of Risky Business there who works in IT on his experience in reporting a workaday bug to Microsoft, and we can only hope that the situation there improves. Okay, well, funnily enough, we're about to do a 180, pretty radical 180 now, from bad Microsoft to good Microsoft. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with John Oberheide, a co-founder of Duo Security. Duo is undoubtedly the industry leader in multi-factor authentication. And, you know, they're pushing their tech beyond just one-time passwords and app-generated passwords and, you know, really pushing things to be able to identify when a device trying to authenticate to a network or service has a problem. A lot of you out there will remember NAC, Network Access Control, which was about sort of gluing your AV software to your network auth, and the idea there was to stop compromised endpoints getting onto your network, but it was never tremendously successful. I mean, I can't remember too many amazing NAC success stories. Well, these days, the operating system and platform vendors are actually opening up their software so that companies like Duo can query endpoint health without having to rely on some bloated third-party horror show to do some basic integrity checking. And of course, this isn't just an 802.1x thing like NAC. You can enforce these checks over the web, and eventually it'll be every device that allows these checks, every device from companies like Microsoft and Google. Now, that's what makes this different. The platform vendors are on board. John joined me to talk all of this over, plus have a chat about their upcoming partnership with Microsoft. Here's what he had to say.
It's actually, in my opinion, you know, the endpoint platform vendors themselves that have made a much bigger impact on hardening devices and, you know, at the end of the day, raising the cost of exploitation, ideally to a place where it becomes, you know, very economically infeasible for adversaries to go after a user, an organization, or a particular platform.
Well, I mean, they are the ones that have always been in the best position to do it. I mean, I think, you know, I remember back in the day when Microsoft finally decided to get a little bit proactive, and they introduced Service Pack 2 for XP, which did such crazy things as like firewalling off all sorts of random services from the internet. Like that had an incredible impact. I mean, they are the companies, the platform makers are the companies who can do the most, aren't they?
Yeah, it's certainly much easier for the first party to do it than the third party to layer on additional security controls, particularly when you're talking about, you know, exploit mitigation, hardening mechanisms that have to live at the oftentimes the heart of the operating system, or sometimes even, you know, below the operating system. But, you know, it is, when you're thinking about the future of the endpoint security market, which is, you know, one of the largest TAMs, and one of the largest markets in the information security space, it is kind of an interesting future to think ahead, you know, 5 to 10 years from now. Like, even in, you know, think about the current day where we have, you know, we've got iOS devices, we've got Chrome OS devices, we've got Windows 10 devices that just have a completely different level of security posture than the, you know, kind of past generation of endpoints. It does paint a much more positive picture for end user computing. I see it as is kind of a transition from, you know, from bolt-on security, you know, bolting on kind of, you know, third-party controls to built-in security for whether it's your latest and greatest kind of authentication factors, whether it's your new endpoint, you know, mitigation mechanisms. But it is absolutely true. Like, this is moving from the kind of open PC environment of literally like general purpose computing to specialized computing. And the fact that, you know, there are the walled gardens of iOS and the app stores, which control the delivery mechanisms of code and applications. And things like Chrome OS, where like I use a Chromebook for my primary computing device. That's easy because I don't do any real work. So, you know, I just browse the web. I use the Chrome browser, and I'm somehow able to produce value for Duo. But obviously that's not the case for all kind of computing use cases. But it is impressive when you look at things like Windows 10, where it has, you know, credential guard, device guard, you know, star guard, as well as things like, you know, Defender that's built in, ATP is built into all new kind of Windows 10 enterprise devices. And even some of the, things that are really interesting to us at Duo are some of these kind of holy grails of device attestation that, you know, academics have been talking about for decades, but now exist in all new Windows 10 devices, that now exist in Chrome OS and Android devices. So for example, on Windows 10, there's a framework called Device Health Attestation. On Android, there's a framework called SafetyNet. On Chrome OS, there's a framework called Verified Access. So that when that device is actually accessing a website, a corporate service or, you know, email, whatever else, that service or say a authentication service like Duo can actually reach out and ask that device questions about its health and its security. And it can do so in a trustworthy and attestable way that's, you know, rooted in the TPM hardware on these new devices. That's a really interesting capability.
I kind of feel like what you're describing is the first awful, awful, awful attempt at NAC, like network access control. And now it's coming back and it's good.
I mean, that's honestly, that's how I describe Duo in some cases to the right audiences. Hopefully your audience. But it's like NAC that doesn't suck, or it's NAC that not only works for your on-prem 802.1x, you know, corporate network environment, which is like the first generation of NAC, like before you plug into the wall, you got to run this terrible, you know, third-party device agent scan that has a ton of vulnerabilities in it itself. This is kind of like first-party supported, trustworthy, I hate to use the word unbypassable, but strong underlying security guarantees in a way that works for any application, whether it's, you know, a cloud app or more of a legacy application.
Well, I mean, having this built in to the actual OS, right? It's not like, hey, in order to determine the trustworthiness of your device, we need you to install Java 4, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Run this Java app, but run the CXE or ActiveX control. So it is interesting that, like, you know, we're having some more kind of new primitives in the platforms like Windows 10 or Chrome OS. And that's, you know, it's still like, you know, for Chrome OS, it's like 0.001% of the population. Windows 10 certainly has, you know, larger adaptation. It does start to hopefully paint a little bit more rosy picture about, you know, how do I actually ensure the integrity of devices that are coming into my enterprise in a way that's not so invasive or not so painful.
How does it work though, right? Like say in the case of Windows 10, because I know you are announcing a partnership with Microsoft, involving all of this stuff. But what sort of questions can you ask a host as part of this process? And how do you make that procedure? First of all, how do you make it so that the host is going to return truthful information? I presume that's involving some crypto magic in a trusted module. But I guess the other question would be like, how do you not open up a whole bunch of attack surface when you're allowing some sort of remote server to query a host about some very delicate questions?
Yeah, there's a lot of there's not only kind of like, you know, security questions raised, but there's lots of privacy questions. And so in the design of these frameworks, folks like Microsoft and Google have had to think carefully about what are the trade-offs here? Can any website on the internet invoke these APIs? Because if they can, and they can obtain, you know, sort of consistent device identifiers, and that's a privacy violation. But, you know, despite the flack that people give Google oftentimes from a privacy perspective, they actually put a lot of work into designing these things the right way, with the right kind of privacy CAs and the right kind of blinding and avoiding you being able to track between multiple websites. But there is kind of this opt-in aspect of it. Like if you work in an organization, your administrator would have to say, I'm allowing Duo to reach out and query my fleet of corporate issued or corporate managed devices.
Tell us about this deal you've got with Microsoft.
Yeah, so, you know, certainly, you know, Microsoft is the king of kind of productivity in enterprise. You know, Office 365 is, you know, by far the kind of top productivity platform for enterprises. Every customer and prospect that we talk to at Duo has these, you know, modernization projects. Like they're moving to modern devices, they're moving to modern applications. You're either in the process right now or it's on your roadmap. Google has a play too there with G Suite, tends to be more kind of SMB and mid-market, but you know, Office 365 and Azure AD is the future for enterprise. And Microsoft has always owned identity through Active Directory. And now they've, you know, taken the steps under, you know, Satya's command to actually bridge that to the cloud in a sane way. And he's really kind of turned around that business as a whole. And what we've seen from Microsoft is that they are excited to partner with the kind of pure play security vendors that are enabling these migrations to happen. So you put yourselves in the shoes of a CISO, they're saying we need to move to Office 365. Like it's not even a we want to, like we have to do it, we have to stay competitive, we have to be productive as an organization. But I've got all of these, you know, on-premise security controls and products that I've invested in. And you know, how do I bridge that to these new environments? How do I regain the same sort of security controls, whether it's authentication, whether it's authorization, both for users and devices? And how do I provide secure access to my cloud apps? And that's an area where Microsoft and Duo have been working together to say, if you're making that jump to Office 365 with Azure AD, you can essentially drop in Duo in a native way that's supported both by Duo and Microsoft. And that's the first third-party integration they've done with an authentication vendor.
What we are seeing more and more is that Microsoft seems to be picking winners, either companies or standards, and actually baking them into the platforms. And it's just generally making life a lot easier.
Yeah, and if you think about it from their perspective, like their incentive is, hey, let's get people on Office 365. That's their bread and butter. Mm. And when they have their customers saying, hey, security is my number one concern when I'm making this migration, they're obviously looking to the broader ecosystem to help solve those problems for them.
All right.
Yubico is a great example of a partner of Duo where we in some ways consider ourselves an authenticator agnostic platform. We're happy to bring in YubiKeys. We're happy to bring in and drive standards like FIDO's E2F and UAF. We're happy to leverage the biometrics, whether it's Touch ID or now Face ID that exist on these, you know, commodity consumer devices. That's a huge plus for us. And we just want to find the right kind of, you know, usability and security profiles that, you know, enable you to have strong authentication kind of in all nooks and crannies of your organization. And we even resell, hardware tokens too, traditional OTP hardware tokens, because for some use cases, if you're in like a SCIF or a call center, you know, that's what you need to do.
No bringing your iPhone into the SCIF, pal.
Yeah.
All right, John Oberheide, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about, what's happening out there in terms of major platform providers trying to fix off, because that's about bloody time.
Thank you, Patrick. You're my favorite human in Australia.
That was John Oberheide there of Duo Security. You can check them out at duo.com, duo.com. It's kind of funny. I never realized until I got towards the end of preparing this week's show that both interviews, sponsor and feature this week, have kind of been about Office 365 authentication. So interesting. But really, if you are looking for an easy solution to the multi-factor authentication issue and challenge, do get in touch with Duo. They know more about this stuff than any other company in the space. They're not just churning out truckloads of keyring tokens because it's a commodity business. They're really good at this and they're continuously pushing it forward. So do check them out at duo.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.